When dark days came upon the people of Israel in the beginning of the 6th century before the Common Era, followed by the loss of their independence, the destruction of Jerusalem and the Holy Temple, and the exile of all but the poorest of the land to Babylon, a great searching of heart and a questioning of all accepted traditional values took place among the people. Had their God forsaken them? He permitted his beloved city and his own temple to be destroyed, and his chosen people to be led away captive by a wicked heathen might? Why? Were they being punished for their sins? If so, had not the Babylonians, their conquerors and captors, had they not also sinned? And if many of the people of Israel had sinned, there surely were many who had not. Why were they slain or driven into captivity? If the fathers had sinned, why were their innocent children punished? Is the way of the Lord just? And what of the future? Will future generations be saddled with the guilt of the present generation, so that there remains no hope ever for a fresh start, for a return and a restoration? In these desperate years of the 6th century, there arose spiritual leaders among the people who frankly faced up to these grave spiritual problems and gave light and guidance to their people to save their generation from spiritual chaos and from a fatal loss of morale. Thus the anonymous prophet whom we call the second Isaiah brought the people in his stirring and eloquent utterances the divine assurance that the iniquity of the past has been forgiven, that the people had already received from the Lord's hand double for all their sins. And he gave the exiles also a vision and a national destiny nobler than any they'd ever envisioned before. They were destined to be the emissaries of the one true God and to carry his moral law to all the nations of the earth. And another prophet of the exile, Ezekiel, faced the problem of individual responsibility. He took sharp issue with those who kept on repeating the proverb, "The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge." "As I live," says the Lord God, "this proverb shall no more be used by you in Israel. The son will not suffer for the iniquity of the father, nor the father for the iniquity of the son. Only the soul that sins shall die." And there is always repentance even for the sinner. God has no pleasure in the death of the sinner, only that he should turn from his evil way and live. But why do innocent people suffer? And why do the wicked often prosper? And is a man's suffering proof that he has been guilty of sin? These problems, which trouble the minds of men, constitute the theme of a remarkable book, the Book of Job, which was also written during the Babylonian exile and about the turn of the 6th century by a Jewish exile. Originally, the book was probably written in Aramaic, a Semitic language very close to the Hebrew, which was spoken in Babylonia and elsewhere in the Near East. And the book was later translated into Hebrew when the exiles returned to Judea. Except for the prologue, which was read this morning, and the brief epilogue at the end of the book, both written in prose narrative, the rest of the book is written in poetry, perhaps the most exalted poetry penned by any man, Jew or non-Jew, in the ancient world. Because of its style, the difficulties involved in translation, the peculiar Oriental form of composition, the editing to which it was undoubtedly submitted through the ages, and the blurring of time, and of course also the obtuse nature of the subject matter itself, the book does not make easy reading, the Book of Job, but it certainly makes very rewarding reading. Now, Job is not a drama in the strict sense of the word. Except for the prologue and the epilogue, it is a debate or a symposium, a problem poem, in which one great theme and its corollaries are discussed from different points of view by four men, Job and his three friends. And the final word is spoken by God himself. A fourth colloquist by the name of Elihu is introduced towards the end of the book, but that is clearly the work of a later editor. Now, to restate the central theme of Job, it is this: if there is a just God in the universe, why does the righteous man suffer? Why does the wicked man often prosper? Or to put it another way, is a man's suffering and personal tragedy proof that he has sinned against God and that God has therefore punished him? Or, broadening the question, why does a good and just God permit suffering altogether and death in this world? And why, having created man mortal, weak, and fallible, does he hold him to such strict accountability and visit upon him such crushing punishment? It is an amazing tribute to the theologic tolerance and the spiritual confidence of the men who finally composed the canon of the Bible that they permitted the inclusion of the Book of Job among the sacred books of the Bible, in spite of the many outspoken strictures and bitter challenges against God and the ordering of his universe, which are found in it. Remember that the Book of Job was a biblical book, a sacred book, and so regarded by our people for centuries. But then, when we call to mind that these same men who composed the canon of the Bible, who put together those 24 books, that these same men also permitted the inclusion of the book of Kohelet, the book of Ecclesiastes, among the books of the Bible, a book whose central theme is not only the apparent absence of justice in the world and the inexplicable suffering of the just, but the utter futility of all existence and the meaninglessness of all life, even where it abounds in pleasure and prosperity. And one becomes aware of it, you realize that the book of books is such because it is the mirror of all life, reflecting all of its moods and touching upon all of its problems. It evades nothing. The answers which it gives may not satisfy everyone, but no one can say that the Bible was unaware of any of the complexities and paradoxes of human existence and refused to face up to the cold, dark problems of man's life upon earth, such as are known to the most modern of the moderns. Now Job had suffered all the agonies and bereavements which a human being could possibly suffer, and he did not know why. Why has God broken him? His three friends, who come to comfort him, try to tell him why. They approach the subject from different directions and with varying emphases, but all their reasoning ultimately converged on one conclusion. Job must have sinned, and God had punished him. And Job refused to accept their explanation. In fact, he bitterly resented it. He was conscious of no sin which could merit such punishment. And his friends became impatient with him. They regarded his attitude as presumptuous, that of a man who is righteous in his own eyes. And each in his own way tells him that God does not pervert justice, and that Job in the past had taught this truth to other men. But now that trials have come upon him, he has become impatient and tears himself in his anger, as the book says. These three friends do not represent three sharply differentiated philosophies or viewpoints, but rather three different emphases or temperaments. Each friend speaks in turn, and in turn Job answers him. And as the debate proceeds in three cycles, each containing six speeches, the argument becomes sharper and more direct, and Job's retorts more passionate and bitter. No quarter is asked or given. The purpose of the friend's visit, that of friendship and condolence, is soon forgotten in the heat of the theologic controversy. Charges and countercharges are hurled. But when the last speech is finally uttered, the issues are not at all resolved. And God himself then appears, and out of the whirlwind utters the word which rebukes the friends and reconciles Job. History and the experience of mankind prove that the wicked are always destroyed and the just are always recompensed, argues one of his friends. Not so, cries Job. God destroys both the blameless and the wicked. If it is not he, who then is it? And why do the wicked live and reach old age and grow mighty in power? You say God stores up their iniquity for their sons? Why does he not recompense them directly so that they may know it? And what of the wronged of the earth? They who carry the sheaves for others but themselves go hungry. They who tread the winepress for others but themselves suffer thirst. Nobody on earth is innocent, argues another of his friends. No man is clean of sin. Behold, even the moon is not bright and the stars are not clear in his sight. How much less man who is a maggot, of the son of man who is a worm? If so, retorts Job, who made him so? Who created man weak and mortal? What is man that thou dost make so much of him, dost visit him every morning and test him every moment? If I sin, what do I unto thee, thou watcher of men? Are not the days of my life few? Let me alone, that I may find a little comfort before I go, whence I shall not return to the land of gloom and deep shadows. You must have sinned, Job, or this evil would not have come upon you, and your wickedness must be great, one of his friends returns to the charge. And it is quite likely that God has exacted of you less than your guilt. What guilt, cries Job? What are my iniquities and my sins? Tell me. You are whitewashing God with lies. Worthless physicians are you all. You speak falsely of God. Your maxims are proverbs of ashes, and your defenses, defenses of clay. I have not sinned. As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood and my tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. Job demands that he be vindicated by God. He will not besmirch his whole life and beat his breast in abject confession to sins which he did not commit, in order to conform to the false and erroneous doctrines about God which these miserable comforters of here were proclaiming. I have understanding as well as you, says Job. I am not inferior to you. What you know, I know also. My agony and anguish are great enough. I am a broken man, and God has cast me into the mire. But I will not destroy my soul, the inner sanctuary of my rectitude and dignity, my last soul and ultimate refuge, by acknowledging to guilt in order to satisfy your dogmas. I know that my vindicator lives, and that at the end he will arise, and in my own lifetime, while my flesh and my skin are still on me, I will see the vindication of God. Umibisari echaze Eloa. For God must maintain the right of a man who is with God. And in all his bitterness and complaint, Job did not deny God. He did not accept his wife's advice, curse God, blaspheme God, and die. He simply did not understand the ways of God. He exercised what he regarded as his human prerogative to question, to complain, to be resentful. And when his friends goaded him by telling him that all his misfortunes were deserved, he became furiously angry and he uttered violent words, bordering on sacrilege and blasphemy against the kind of a God whom his friends champion. Job was waiting for his God, the true God, to arise and vindicate him. And out of the whirlwind, God speaks and answers Job. Job is vindicated by God. His friends are condemned, not only for imputing sin to Job who had not sinned, but for not having spoken of God what is right, as Job had done. And they must now ask Job to pray for them, that God might forgive them and not deal with them according to their folly. Job had come through his testing, unshaken in his faith, in spite of all the terrible visitations which had come upon him. And the moral of the parable, well, the book of Job was a parable. Job was not an historic figure. Iyov lo hayav lo nivra ela mashalu. Job never lived, never existed. It is a parable, said the rabbis. The moral of the parable is clear. A true man of piety remains steadfast in his faith in spite of all loss or torment or doubt, for that is the very measure and criterion of faith. Faith is not knowledge. Faith chooses the way of complete trust in the face of incomplete knowledge. What is paradoxical to the mind is not a block either to spiritual confidence or to moral action. A man of faith is frequently baffled in the presence of a meaning not yet grasped, perhaps never to be fully grasped by man's limited mind. But a man of faith will never acknowledge defeat either in agnosticism or atheism. A man's faith must always function within limitations, within the inevitable limitations of the human position. Limited days, limited powers, limited comprehension, in a world whose laws he did not set, whose origin and destiny have not been revealed to him, but these are the unalterable terms of reference of his life. And within these terms and these limitations, God fashioned man as he fashioned all creation and charged man to grow and develop in mind and spirit, to live according to the moral law which he revealed to him, and to build a good society. And the man of faith accepts both God's mandate and his terms. Now Job had accepted God's mandate to lead a righteous life. He was a good and righteous man. But he rebelled at the terrible terms and conditions of his life. He did not understand, and he wanted to know the why and the wherefore. And God's answer is given to Job to remind him that he, Job, did not create this universe or set its laws. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? The conditions of all creations were set by God, not man. He alone knows the why and the wherefore. Man himself is a creature and has neither the power nor the wisdom to create or to understand the vast universe and the laws which govern it. Man can understand neither life, nor death, nor mind, nor cosmic origins, nor the purposes of creation. And God's justice in relation to man is not the only mystery which surrounds the position of man on earth. But if you, Job, do discern plan and order and law and grandeur in the whole of creation, why do you not trust the Creator that the same wisdom and order obtain also in the human world, which is also of God's making? Man's highest wisdom, Job, is not to question the ways of the Almighty. Trying to understand them will not advance or ennoble your life. Behold, reverence for God that is wisdom, and to depart from evil, that is understanding. And interestingly enough, this is the same answer which is also given in the Bible to the complaints of Koheleth, of Ecclesiastes, the king who had everything, tasted everything, but who in his prosperity, not in his adversity as Job, but in his prosperity, found everything to be stale and meaningless, hevel, havalim, vanity of vanities. To him also the same answer is given. The end of the matter, after everything has been said, after the debate is all over, revere God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole. Job, the good man, who in his tribulations had argued with God and had been a fault finder, comes finally to understand this. I uttered that which I understood not. I spoke things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I had heard of thee heretofore by the hearing of the ear, imperfectly, but now my eye sees thee more clearly. Therefore I despise myself for what I have spoken and repent in dust and ashes. Now the playwright Archibald MacLeish has employed this superb parable of Job for the plot of his play, JB. He has given it a modern dress and a contemporary setting. And this is a legitimate undertaking, for the meaning of suffering is a timeless theme, and there have never been and there can never be the complete answers to eternal problems. The play, JB, has imagination, deep earnestness, poetic flashes of great insight, and all the pathos of the suffering Job of the Bible. Perhaps JB's misfortunes, the play, suffer from an excess of harrowing detail, which the greater artistry of the book of Job avoids. JB is a successful, self-confident American businessman, a religious man who has a loving wife and family, and a series of tragedies similar to those of Job overtake them. His children are killed in war, in accidents, in foul rape and murder. He loses his fortune and is broken by disease. And his wife finally deserts him because he will not curse God for the terrible misfortunes which had been visited upon them. The three friends who come to pay him a condolence call are, since each generation has its new comforters, a psychoanalyst, a leftist sociologist, and a religious fundamentalist. And their attempts, slyly travestied in the play, to explain the reason for human suffering are perhaps the best intellectual tidbits of the play. JB rejects the arguments of these friends. Two broken-down actors selling popcorn and balloons in the circus tent where the play is enacted, and who from time to time put on the masks of Satan and God, identify and comment on the action of the play as it goes along to heighten its tension. And at decisive moments, the voice of God himself is heard out of the void, speaking the words which the Bible attributes to him. There is introduced also something resembling a Greek chorus composed of slatternly women of dubious character whose function in the play is not quite clear, just as the business with the masks, also a Greek theatrical device, is also not clear. On reading the play, and later on viewing it on the stage, I could not escape the impression that modern man has not advanced much beyond the man of ancient times in understanding man's relation to God or God's way in the world. In fact, MacLeish throws in the sponge in the second act. Up to that time, he had been moving confidently along in the footsteps of his ancient model, poignantly restating the problem, the innocent sufferer and the unapproachable God. But when you look for MacLeish's own solution, you are keenly disappointed. You feel let down. The play seems to fall apart after J.B. acknowledges his littleness before God. And what follows is simply a complete non sequitur, a volte-face. It does not flow logically from what went before. MacLeish offers no solution except to veer away from the problem altogether and to confront human suffering as a non-religious, secular existentialist would face it. But of course, if there is no God who concerns himself with man, there is no problem of God's justice. But it is this problem which is the very theme and substance of the religious debate, which is Job. In Job, God remains central at all times, both to the problem and its solution. In J.B., God is deftly, almost imperceptibly whisked away towards the end of the play, and thereafter, a non-religious humanism takes over, seemingly to ensure a clear sailing into a safe harbor. J.B. recovers from his leprosy, and in spite of all that had happened to him and his family, assures us that he is now willing to begin life all over again. He becomes, in the hands of MacLeish, the symbol of the undefeated man. His wife, Sarah, who had deserted him because he would not curse God, now returns to him because Job had finally understood that there is no justice in the world, only love. Sarah must be referring, of course, to human justice, not to divine justice, or human love, not to divine love. For if the killing of her children was not divine justice, it certainly was not divine love. But if there is no possibility on earth even of human justice, what then is the meaning of all man striving to build a just society? And if men can never be just to one another, how can they ever come to love one another? The contrast between justice and love, whether human or divine, is nowhere raised in the book of Job. In J.B., it constitutes the very climax of the play, and it's altogether unrelated to all that preceded. I am afraid that Mr. MacLeish could not resist his early church training, where the now discredited antitheses between Old Testament justice and New Testament love was made much of. The problem of Job, however, was not whether men should love one another or be just to one another, but whether God is just and loving. Now, conceivably, one could write a secular non-religious play on the theme, how best man can come to terms with misfortune. It is doubtful in my mind whether the climax of such a play would be any more comforting than Job's to parents whose hearts had been torn by the tragic loss of all their children who themselves had been destroyed in fortune and health. And one wonders whether after listening to all the clamatory rhetoric about the homo invictus, my head is bloody but unbowed, I am master of my fate, I am captain of my soul, one wonders whether these parents would not be inclined to cry out with Job, I have heard many such things before. Miserable comforters are you all. When will all such windy words have an end? But such a play could be written. In fact, more than one has been written. But Archibald MacLeish has lashed his play onto the book of Job and would have you believe that it is written true to its spirit, in spite of the fact that he has rather high-handedly converted an ancient religious classic whose Alpha and Omega is God into a secularist tract whose hero rises by his own powers from the ashes, heals himself by his own powers, and announces that he's now going to accept life again, start over, get new children, face the same risk, the same hazards, because he is a man. MacLeish himself wrote in explanation of his play that he derived it all from the story of Job itself and from the end of the book, a part of the myth which he says that the theologians, for obvious reasons, neglect or disparage. And what excited me about the end was something that is obviously there, but is omitted from the biblical account, Job's action. In the Bible, God gives Job back everything. But God's giving implies Job's acceptance. And it was that acceptance that haunted my mind. That is as pure and naked affirmation of the fundamental human belief in life in spite of life, the fundamental human love of life as life, and in spite of all the miseries of life as I've ever found. It is the more moving, he says, because the theologians have never noticed it, or more precisely cannot notice it, being theologians. The book of Job is a human triumph. Job picking up his life again. To all of which one is inclined to say, it is true that all this was omitted from the biblical account for obvious reasons. For obviously, it was never intended to be there. The theologians never noticed it, because it was never there to be noticed. The end of the parable of Job, how God restored Job's fortune as a reward for his faith and steadfastness, was never ignored by theologians, except by some modernists who attracted to this superb classic, who sought to make it present their own views, and attempted arbitrarily to fit their own tailored notions onto the book. The love of life and the clinging to life is shared also by animals. It possesses no special moral virtue or significance. All living things want to live. At the end, Job of the Bible goes on his way confidently with God, confirmed in his own integrity and trusting in the justice and goodness of the Creator of the universe, though his ways are not always clear to him. At the end, J.B. of Archibald MacLeish goes on his way gropingly without God, relying on his own strength and still living in a hostile and darkened world. Blow on the coal of the heart. The candles in churches are out. The lights have gone out in the sky. Blow on the coal of the heart, and we'll see by and by. At the end, Job humbles himself before God while preserving his own spiritual dignity. He trusts God and leaves the management of the world to him. Job accepts the world, and abandoning all futile questioning and rebelliousness, carries on in faith, prepared to do whatever God assigns to him. At the end, J.B. refuses to humble himself. He still remains resentful of the hard, unheeding world about him, for which God has no concern whatsoever. And defiantly, he will pick up his life again, even if it means going through the same series of disasters as before, for he will now have not a confidence in God, for he will now have the love of Sarah, his wife, with him. Sarah, who first abandoned and then returned to him. But Sarah and her love were with him before the disasters overtook them. Why did they not suffice then? And will love suffice when the next horrors sweep over them? I rather think that J.B. will have a sadder road to travel alone than Job of old with his God. If the play J.B. sends people back to read the book of Job thoughtfully, Archibald MacLeish may turn out to be, however unwittingly, a true benefactor of that glowing religious faith which was with the biblical author of Job.